Well, just to finish the day, we have a very short period of time, 15 minutes, just for comments, questions, any queries about anything we've done today or has been said. Sorry, I'll repeat.
Look at them without judgment. But what is in between? Not to desire?
Okay. I'm paraphrasing that question, so I have to correct me if I get it. I didn't get it quite right. I spoke about five elements, I spoke about stillness of the mind. And five elements, the five hindrances that I spoke about. And the question really seemed to be about, well, what happens on the observation of those five hindrances, whether it's to not desire if you observe desire. Okay. Well, when we are observing desire... Actually, let me go back to something I said earlier on. Remember I said earlier on that when I normally... When we're in normal life, we don't tend to observe desire. What we tend to find ourselves is in modes of behaviour. So I find myself buying something or eating something or whatever it is without really observing that that desire has crept up on me, that craving is there. What this is doing is giving you an opportunity to observe the arising of it. And say an opportunity, because not every time will you observe it, you'll find yourself fantasizing about it and having a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or thinking about what you're going to do or whatever the craving is about. But sometimes, because of this slowing down of the mind, the stilling of the mind, you'll start to see something arising. Now, if you start to see something, you then begin to have choice. Whether to follow through that desire or to detach yourself from that desire. Does that make sense?
So you mean desire is bad?
Desire in general doesn't get us into very good places. Now, some desires are perfectly okay. Yeah, if it's food, drink, shelter, things like that, fine. What's the problem? I don't see a problem with that. A lot of the desires or the cravings that we have don't get us into good places because of some of the things I said earlier on, because we think they're going to give us something which they don't. Happiness, contentment, peace. You know, if I had this, I would get some contentment. If I was with this person, I'd be a happy person. Myths that we tell ourselves about. So often it doesn't get us into where we want to be, it gets us into further dissatisfaction. Yeah? So I'm not saying all desire is bad, I'm saying certain types of desires and cravings don't get us into good places. And what they do is they end up creating a bigger problem than we have. Now, in the procedure that we're going through, in meditation, we get a chance to observe the desires arising because of that slowing down of the mind. If I begin to observe it, then I get an opportunity to either follow it, if I want to, don't think there's any problem with it, or if I think there's a problem with it, to have a choice and detach myself from it. So that's really all we're doing, is creating a space of choice about what we do, rather than being just reactive. Okay? Now, there's a big distinction I just want to make, and it's really on the back of your question, it's not directly your question here, but the distinction really is made, and this is really what meditation is about in general, it's to move from a position of reaction to a position of action. So I might still do the same thing, but now I know why I'm doing it, rather than simply doing it, because I'm doing it out of choice. So, for example, I could reactively, let's take a very simple example, I could reactively every day when I come in from work switch on the television. because that's what I do. It's a so-called relax, I switch on the television. That is just purely a reactive pattern. We do it automatically. I might come in with a different mind and say, I know why I'm doing this, and I'm still going to do it. That's a completely different position, because some days you might not do it. Yeah? Because you know why you're doing it. Because there might not be the need, the necessity. So it's moving from that position of automaticity, doing something automatically or reactively, to doing something with proper volition, with proper, with a whole mind instead of just part of your mind. That's really, again, it's partly based on your question.
So today that we've spent most of the time on the breath as the object of our awareness,
yeah.
Is there any distinction that if you were using the body more as your way of anchoring and coming back and observing the mind, and you do that routinely, staying just with the body, is there an argument for doing all of the four that are in the Satipatthana? Will there be holes in your practice if you tend to stay with the body more than the breath?
Did everybody hear that? It's really a question about the body. We've spent pretty well most of the day, apart from the walking meditation, dealing with the breath. We started with the body, even with breath meditation, because it's the experience of the whole body breathing, not just at the tip of the nose. I suggested to you that, for example, you can observe the abdomen. I mean, these are all standard places to place the attention here. And the question really was, is if you stayed with the body, just with the body per se, would you be missing out on something? Would there be holes in your practice? I think that's what you were asking about it. Particularly in pursuing the four ways of founding mindfulness. Yeah. Interestingly, when we look at these four ways of founding mindfulness, what are known as Satipatthana, this very, very famous sutta, which is a discourse for those who don't know what that means, by the Buddha, then interestingly, the largest section out of the whole of that text is the section on the body. Interestingly, an awful lot of that section doesn't get practiced in Western circles. Mindfulness of breath is mindfulness of body. It's within that section. Mindfulness of the, say, abdominal movement, strictly speaking, isn't supposed to be mindfulness of body. It's something called mindfulness of the air element. Which is slightly different. But in general, mindfulness of breath is always included as the first way of establishing mindfulness of body. The Buddha gives very specific, well, fairly specific for these texts. He gives fairly specific instructions to know that you're taking a long breath, to know you're taking a short breath, to become aware of the texture of the breath, for example. He says, just as a skilled person on an ancient lathe would be aware that they were making a long turn or a short turn on one of these wood lathes that you would use. So that's all included within mindfulness of body. So it's not a separate practice. Now that, I want to make that clear. Actually, when you move into the second section of the Satipatthana, you're also not dealing with a second separate practice, because this is what's called mindfulness of Vedana, Vedana Anupassana. Vedana Anupassana is actually the recollection or the mindfulness of Vedana or sensation, what's generally translated as feeling, which is pleasant, unpleasant, and neither, as it arises, particularly in regard to body sensations. So we never really move away from body. Then you have distinct sections on mindfulness of mind and then mindfulness of what make up the contents of the mind, which are much, much more difficult. Those first two sections, I think, are the most important sections in the establishing of mindfulness in general. So if you stay with mindfulness body, you're certainly not missing out. there's not going to be great gaps in your practice. Mindfulness of breath, I think, is one of the basic practices. I think it's an extremely important practice, particularly in the Western world, where often we don't stay with that sense of the embodied breath long enough. We don't really have a good sense of that embodied breath at all. As some of you might know, there's a character in one of James Joyce's stories called Mr. Duffy, who lives at some distance from his body. He's described as. And I think that's a lot of Western people. We still, despite a lot of body work that's done in the West with yoga and Tai Chi and all of these things, there's still a lot of distance from the body. Mindfulness of breath is a way of getting that, particularly mindfulness of the whole body breath is a particular way of dealing with that. Now, we could have spent a lot more doing that today, but we're trying to get to this idea of stilling the mind a little. Yeah. But there certainly wouldn't be big holes in your practice if you did only that. Yeah. Interestingly, when one kind of looks and delves into the texts of the Buddha's own awakening, his practice was mindfulness of breathing. Not other really complicated esoteric practices, it was mindfulness of breathing, according to that.
Sorry, you talked about a kind of mind game that can play. Where do you put in like intuition or gut reaction to this? Do you believe intuition? Is that part of your mind or is that part of you? Where does that fit in?
Intuition, that's a strange word, isn't it? Intuition can cover a multitude of sins in the West, I think. You don't actually have a word for it in Pali and Sanskrit, for intuition. It's not a word that's used in the early texts. The word that's used generally is insight. There's a number of different ways of talking about that. For example, there's the development of insight, which is usually known as vipassana, or there is understanding, which is insightful understanding, which is known as panya or prajna in Pali and Sanskrit. What marks the difference between those is that this is an embodied understanding. It's an embodied insight. In other words, it's a way of seeing. If you take the word vipassana, and it's a long way around getting to your question, but I'll get there in a second. If you take the word vipassana, it actually means something like a clear seeing. Passana comes from the verb to see, passati in Pali. So it means a clear seeing of something. Now, if you clearly see something, you literally live it. Does that make sense? Okay. Tell me if you're not with me, because I'll try and explain this a little bit differently if it's a bit complex. What we're trying to do in the practice is develop a clear understanding, a clear seeing of something. For example, let's take a very particular thing, impermanence. You're trying to clearly see impermanence in life. If I clearly see impermanence, it makes me live in a particular way. Hopefully. In other words, I don't grasp after things because I know that they're impermanent. I don't cling to them. I don't hold on to them in quite the same way. Even including my own life, I don't hold on to it in quite the same way because it's impermanent. Intuition, I think, is a slippery word in English. Yeah, it's a slippery word because it almost like feels like a gut feeling, but it isn't actually embodied so much. It may be, and it may have similarities to the word insight, but I don't think in English it's something identical to that. It can be, but I think a lot of the time it isn't. It's just a vague sort of understanding of something or a vague feeling about something. In Buddhist terms, in the terms of the practice, it would be turning that vague feeling into whether it really is a good understanding of something. So you might be building on what you would call an intuition. But we would, in terms of practice, I wouldn't always trust those intuitions. Not until they've really become, in a sense, embodied. Then it changes its shape and then becomes an insight. It's a long way around, wasn't it, so trying to answer that question. I hope that was comprehensible. The part of the problem is you don't have this word, as I say, in the original languages. Yeah. It's a very English word.
Can you say a bit more about what you mean by embodied?
Embodied.
Becomes embodied.
What I mean by embodied is you literally walk it, talk it, sleep it, live it. That's what I mean by embodied. It becomes an embodied understanding. Let me take you something which is really... I think most people will understand. But if we talk about the importance of kindness and compassion. Now, we can have kindness and compassion as a thought. But kindness and compassion, interestingly, again, in these languages, is something you do. You know, so the word compassion, karuna, in the original language, derives from a verb which means to do something. It comes from kriya, which means to do something. So compassion isn't a thought in your head. It's something you do. Yeah? Does that again make sense? It gets away from it. You know, I can sit here so-called feeling compassionate but not doing anything about it. And so it only really becomes compassion when I start to act physically, bodily, with compassion, with a gesture, you know. And I think we see this in people who are genuinely compassionate. They have a different body aspect to them. I mean, many, I don't want to kind of glorify him, but many people say the Dalai Lama, one of the things about the Dalai Lama is his engagement, his physical engagement with people. I mean, I was at a meeting in Oxford kind of a number of years ago where there's these Oxford professors who we were meeting him privately. And the first thing he did was hold one of their hands for the whole time he talked to them. Of which he was sort of going... And it was just that sort of physicality that we're so unused to in the West. And that was a kind of kindness that was coming through his speech. But it was coming out in an embodied way as well. And that's what I mean by being embodied. Yeah. And we can embody an understanding. And I think only when we embody that understanding is it real understanding, rather than just head understanding. Yeah. So it's coming much, much more to our physical sense of being in this world, rather than just as often we can be, just disembodied heads. You know, in terms of our thought processes. You know, I can have all the good thoughts in the world, but they never come out in action. It doesn't really make much difference, does it? You know, it's only when it comes out physically, you know, when, for example, I do comfort somebody by putting an arm around them or physically move towards them, even if I don't touch them, in that way, that, you know, people get a real sense that there is compassionate understanding or kind understanding or whatever it is present here at this moment. I think it's a really, really important thing. Just one more. I'm sorry this has been so short.
I just wonder if you'd offer a bit more guidance in terms of letting go of the breath. Because I find as soon as I start to kind of concentrate on the breath, I'm effectively, you know, it's like an accordion or something. I find it hard just to sort of watch the breath.
Just watch that. I'm not quite clear about what you're meaning by letting go of the breath.
Well, I guess I'm conscious that as I start to meditate quite mm-hmm. often, I'm effectively controlling the breath.
Okay.
I'm not able to just sort of let it be or to allow it.
Does that happen no matter where you place your focus?
I thought it was quite interesting the instructions you gave today about the kind of full bodied awareness and then going on, which I think helped.
Right.
That I was still felt in certain parts. It was like my mind was controlling breath rather than my mind resting onto the breath.
This is not unusual. This is not unusual. Often what happens is that we're not just observing, we're thinking about. Mm. When you're thinking about, you're controlling. It's often when we, for example, even look at the body, we don't just observe the body, we think about the body, and then thinking about it, you control it again. So there's something about thinking mind which is about controlling mind. Observe that happening. This is not a problem. You know, gradually, and particularly experiment with placing the breath. It might be, for example, that with too tight a restriction, you're thinking about it too much. Mm. There's too many thought processes holding it. Use that full sense of body awareness, of the body breath. of the body breathing. Taking it out in that more expansive awareness might lessen your sense of control. But this is not unusual. This is virtually, I think, where everybody starts. There's almost always some degree of control initially. It's almost like relaxing to the breath, relaxing to its coming and going. But try with a wider focus initially rather than a narrow focus. If you feel that there's less control, then you can try a slightly narrower focus. If you feel control comes back in, taking it out and widen it. But I'd certainly start with a wider sense at this stage. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. I'm sorry to say. Well, all I can say is thank you to everybody for participating today. These days don't happen. I just want to make a quick thank you to everybody at London Insight for organising these days. They take a lot of organising, as I'm sure you can appreciate. So thank you to you, and thank you to London Insight.
And I think particularly